You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Round, round, get around, I get around. Yeah, get around, round, round, I get around. I get around.
As I mentioned a little bit ago, probably about a month ago, I saw a headline that caught my eye. I first saw it as a press release, a media release from the VA, and then I saw articles written about it. And the gist of the headline was: married military veterans are at more risk, and females are at more risk for suicide than others. I started rooting around to find out where I would interview somebody who took part in this. And lo and behold, I crossed paths with Merrick Kolpak. He is a MD, PhD. He's a health science specialist, U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, part of the Vision 2 Center of Excellence for Suicide Prevention. Did I say all that right, Merrick?
It's Vision, the Veterans Integrated Service Network. It's just a functional unit of how the VA is organized.
Okay. First of all, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. We need to learn a little bit about you first. Born and raised where?
So born in Chicago. I grew up in Phoenix. And then I had the unique privilege and opportunity to go to school in Poland. And that's where I went to medical school, and that's where I completed my PhD in medical sociology.
Okay, well, there's a lot of consonants in your name. So is the Polish thing, is that a family thing? Is that why you went to school there? That's a bit Phoenix. Phoenix to Poland, although both cities... the city and the nation start with a P. That's about all they have in common. Explain that logical leap to Poland.
Well, thank you for that question. Yes, I am ethnically Polish. Both my parents immigrated from Poland many decades ago, and I'm a proud first-generation American.
So did you grow up speaking Polish?
Indeed, I did. We grew up in a bilingual home.
There you go. And so in Chicago, there's a huge Polish community there, yes?
Oh, very sizable. Very sizable indeed.
All right. So talk to us about that. What was it like to go live in Poland?
Oh, it was one heck of a culture shock. Polish society... Let me state the obvious. It's unique unto itself. They have their own way of doing things, their own way of thinking. Some of it matches with our American concepts of, let's say, customer service, of arranging different formalities, bureaucracy, etc. But on the other end, they have their own ways, systems, laws, rules, regulations. So it was a very interesting opportunity to really learn from the inside of how Polish society lives, works, studies, their priorities, leisure activities. And it was also a great opportunity to do some traveling and really see some new countries, new cities. Take in a lot of history, so it was really a great experience. I learned a lot, and it was really a chance to grow and develop academically and personally. And I will also add that I was fortunate enough to marry the prettiest girl in Poland, so I often joke that I got the platinum package in that regards.
Nice. I want to ask you about that. I want you to know that I'm a bit of a Polish scholar, although I'm American by birth. I don't really identify very much with my Irish roots, although I can imitate the brogue if I feel like it. And when I've had a couple of drinks, I can do a little bit of an Irish jig, but it's really not much of one. I just do what I've seen on the river dance on TV. So anyway, things that surprised you about Poland. You talked about things that do lean west and things that would be symmetrical with Western culture. What is asymmetrical with Western culture that is normal in Poland that if we went there today we'd find?
Oh, that's a tough question. I lived there for 13 years.
Well,
so
come on.
What could we possibly suggest? Here's one for you then.
Okay.
Polish society is by and large very quiet. Here in upstate New York, for example, if you'll go out to a restaurant, a bar, meeting your friends on the town, there are lots of hugs, handshakes, laughter, conversation. But in Polish society, it struck me that things were a little bit more, maybe mellow is too strong of a word, but people were a bit more reserved in their mannerisms, in their way of talking. And that took a little bit of getting used to, of adapting myself accordingly to my speakers, my friends, colleagues, professors that I would be working with and interacting with on an everyday basis.
Interesting. The best food, if I were to travel to Poland today, the best food, I'm a Polish scholar because I read Michener's Poland, just so you know.
Fantastic novel. Fantastic novel.
You know, it is. It starts with Jan of the Birch Trees in like 900 AD. That's where this thing starts, and you understand, you get a sense of the Polish, I'm not sure that it's real, you could tell me, their black sense of humor. Their dark sense of humor, in that they are the, I don't want to say the speed bump, but they're certainly the, avenue that wars, nations transit to fight each other. And so they go back and forth a few times over the course of their history between Germany and Russia, France. And, so their humor, their dark sense of humor is certainly documented in the book. But it is, and the way Michener writes it, generation after generation after generation, you certainly do get that sense. The best food in Poland is?
Oh, goodness. Best food in Poland. My personal favorite are the soups. Polish society has mastered the art of making different soups and stews. However, it's funny that you mentioned just really food. Poland is an incredibly diverse country. They have a coastline and they have rugged mountain ranges, so you can get everything from fresh seafood to mountain trout. And so there's a great, beautiful diversity of ingredients that you can see applied in different parts of the country and in different dishes. But, my personal favorite growing up, and also going to school there, were really just the different soups and stews that they've managed to, really master. That just really hits the spot every time.
All right, one final question about Poland.
Please.
I love these kind of conversations and these liberal arts discussions that I have with different guests on the program because I find it fascinating. Recently, Poland was in the news, and they've enacted a law that says it's a crime in Poland now to identify the Poles as the persecutors of the Jews. Was that something that you experienced in terms of when the subject of either concentration came up or the German occupation of Poland in World War II, that they were very adamant about that we didn't kill Jews here. They were killed here, but it wasn't by Poles, and any Poles that participated with a gun to their head. Can you provide any illumination to that law for us? Because I certainly, you know, and I think the world noticed Israel's reaction to it. But if I was a Pole, I'd be on the Polish side of this argument. Hey, stop painting us with that brush. That wasn't us. That was the Germans. Hello? So your thoughts?
Well, yes, they have been in the news very recently for the reasons you identified. I'm not familiar with the specific intricacies of that law that was enacted, so I really can't speak to what that law covers or what it does not cover. However, quoting the textbooks here, Poland's history, especially recent history, the First World War, the Second World War, were extremely complex. And so it would be an oversimplification at any level to try to summarize who acted how and in what circumstances, in a single sentence. But, what I can say is, as far as I'm familiar with the subject matter, it's being very extensively studied, examined, historically, both in Poland and in Israel. And, what absolutely warrants mention is in the Garden at Yad Vashem, the righteous among the nations, the largest national group of people who saved Jews during the Second World War is from Poland. So a lot really can be said about that, how Polish people, despite all the struggles and risks involved, really did step up to the plate and fought valiantly and courageously to save and support Jewish lives. Were there other challenges, difficulties? The word that's been tossed around, collaboration, or traitors, or however you want to phrase it, I'm sure there probably were isolated instances. I recollect as much being said in the news, different politicians, but I'll leave those sorts of details to the historians and the people who are really in the thick of things, looking at facts and studying the subject matter more thoroughly.
Was it a sentiment that was popular that you would hear in discussions that, or is this a political? I don't want to say a manufactured political event, but is it something that you bumped into in conversation in Poland, or not? Your personal experience.
My personal experience, by all means. Yes. As a matter of historical discussion, it is something that's talked about. It is something that's discussed. I mean, it's part of the national identity. Everything that happened during the Second World War. What warrants mention is that before the Second World War, before Nazi occupation, there was a extremely sizable Jewish population in Poland, and they were absolutely integrated. People were living together in peace. It was a matter of everyday reality that my Jewish neighbor, my Polish Catholic friend, there was absolutely no animosity or anything along those lines. But then came the invasion, the Second World War, and the rest, as they say, is history. So the relationship between Jews and Poles, again, I'm not a historian here, but I think it's safe to say that yes, it is complex, but at the same time, it is part of this collective national identity for both people. Who shared in those same moments at that exact same time in history.
All right. My guest, who is our Polish cultural expert today, is very, very unbeknownst to him, by virtue of the way we planned the interview, is Dr. Merrick Kolpak. And we're supposed to be talking about the suicide and a study that that Merrick was a part of. But we're talking a little bit about Poland here. And I thank you for the interesting deviation from the path. First of all,
not a problem. It's my wonderful pleasure.
How did you get involved? First of all, in your chosen field. Why did you choose it? And then after, you know, talk about that, and then we'll talk about how this particular study got started and how you got involved in it. So why this line of work?
Why this particular line of work? Excellent question. Excellent question. So when I was in graduate school, I was studying medical sociology, which, using a broad strokes brush, really describes how different variables in society, not necessarily at the microscopic level of germs or bacteria or cells, but stuff that happens all around us, where we live, how we live, who we interact with, how we interact with others, really stands to impact health outcomes in a very real, very tangible way. And so that was the moment when I got bit by the bug, that look how much we can do, how much we can change for the better if we only were to do X, Y, Z, and ABC a little bit differently. Changing how we interact with others, what we say or how we do it. So those sorts of societal level variables really fascinated me for a long time. And to make a short answer exceptionally long, I received a call from the Center of Excellence for Suicide Prevention in Canandaigua, and they extended an invitation if I'd like to come on board as a researcher. And here we are talking a little more than 6 years later. We've made incredible headway into our understandings of how religious coping affects suicide risk, affects different behaviors, and I'm exceptionally proud of the work that we're doing over here.
So, Merrick, this particular study, is it part of a broader effort? Tell us about this particular study and what the study endeavored to do.
The short answer is yes, it is part of a broader effort, the broader suicide prevention effort for the whole VA. It is a high priority item, needless to add, across the entire VA healthcare system, that considerable time, effort, resources are being devoted to preventing suicide in veteran populations. And so this particular study that I authored with my colleagues, Hugh Crean, Crystal Park, and Ranny Hoff, titled Religious Coping and Suicide Risk in a Sample of Recently Returned Veterans. As the name implies, it was a unique sample population of recently returned veterans that were surveyed approximately within 1 year of being discharged from military service. And so that particular sample population, their insights, their thoughts and experiences are exceptionally valuable because we recognize that recently returned veterans face certain challenges of readjusting to civilian settings with their families, with their coworkers, with their broader community. And so in taking on this particular data analysis, we were really trying to identify ways to help this particular group of veterans and identify certain relationships that could help inform future larger suicide prevention efforts. And our findings have proven very promising and really are feeding into a broader discussion of suicide prevention efforts, as well as, of course, helping those recently returned veterans.
All right. Did the results surprise you? They surprised me. My assumption would be that the most at risk would be divorced because they're alone or single. But the least at risk would be married because you come home. I think one of the things that I've learned after three, deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan is, I think you require, and this is like a very un-Marine thing to say, but you require intimacy, and you require it more because you need to talk to somebody. You need to feel close to somebody, and those things are those needs are greater. So I think it seems to me that, and one of the reasons I was surprised was that married people have that intimacy waiting for them in a spouse. Yet your study finds contrary to that.
Affirmative. There is no denying that we stumbled on an interesting finding. And I would like to just caution all our listeners against any sort of thinking or oversimplification that we are absolutely not in any way, shape, or form saying that marriage causes suicide. That is not the takeaway message here. What we are saying is that we found a group of veterans within this recently discharged sample population that in that process of transitioning back home, some of them were found to be in a higher category of risk. And indeed, this finding was very novel. It has not been replicated in many other studies because, indeed, the prevailing opinion is marriage, children, family serve as a source of support, as a buffer against suicidal behavior. So our finding here, a correlational finding, not a causational finding, really left us scratching our heads a little bit, but it absolutely warranted mention because, as we framed it in our paper, what we noted was that the period of reintegration is challenging for a lot of folks. It is challenging. They're having to readjust to a new dynamic, a new way of relating with others, a new way of developing that intimacy that you referred to. And so we contextualize that in that way. And so this finding really serves as food for thought of how prevalent is this problem and what supportive options are there available now for this group of veterans that might be having difficulty in their home environment, and what supportive options should we be developing, enhancing, to more effectively and really best meet their needs at that present time. And I'm proud to say that the VA does offer a variety of supportive services, marriage enrichment, counseling, couples therapy, assuming those were the issues that these individuals might have been dealing with at that moment.
Right.
The Warrior to Soulmate, this is what the program is called, has been overseen by the VA Chaplaincy Service, and there's some preliminary data which really shows that this marriage enrichment program does yield a very positive benefit of helping facilitate communication between spouses and improving a lot of outcomes, including mental health outcomes, where such problems may have existed. So we've drawn attention to an important issue, an important problem. We are devoting considerable efforts and resources to mitigating that problem, all with the aim of really preventing suicide and improving health outcomes among the veterans that we serve.
Okay, now I have a question and a comment relative to that, but I want to, before I ask that, I want you to talk about your findings relative to women, which I think I've heard those stories before that the fastest growing segment relative to suicide is the number relative to women. I don't know that I'm surprised by that because more and more women are serving forward. And so instead of being in purely support roles where they would be somewhat insulated from it, they're now more forward. So talk to me about your findings relative to women.
So what we know about suicide among women veterans is that they are at an increased risk of suicide relative to their civilian counterparts.
Okay.
However, women are not at an increased risk relative to male veterans.
Okay.
So that's one piece of information there. But absolutely, I concur with your comment that the risk of suicide among female veterans is growing considerably. And the VA is devoting a sizable amount of effort, again, to women's health, identifying specifically unique needs of women veterans. Our understandings of suicide risk, broadly defined, different risk factors, risk variables, are forcing us to really take a step back and seeing how those understandings apply to both women and men versus applying more to one gender versus the other. As you rightfully noted, the number of women who are serving in our armed forces is growing, and we absolutely applaud and salute their efforts, their service. And so I really want to drive the point home that we're mindful of the unique healthcare needs that women specifically might face relative to their male counterparts, and how that also relates to potentially an increased risk of suicide. And our study is one example of how we are purposefully looking at how understandings of suicide risk apply to women veterans. As part of the sample population of recently returned veterans, there was a purposeful oversampling of female veterans. And so what that really gives us is an added higher degree of insight to say that, wow, look, these relationships really stand out when we're dealing with female veterans as opposed to male veterans. And so that was one of the unique points that we were able to make in our study.
All right. My experience with suicide, this is from somebody who has a BA in economics, so take it for what it's worth.
Okay.
Because suicide impacts us all substantially, and there's nothing that sets you back more than, you know, somebody who you've deployed with, and you're fortunate enough to come home, and then, you know, you've survived, you know, places like Ramadi and Fallujah where I've served, and then, you know, you just get this crushing text message or email or phone call that says, hey, so-and-so's killed themselves. And then we play this game in the military that did they rate to kill themselves? Okay. And so as we, the survivors, think, well, what did he go through that other people didn't? And some people will look at it and say, he didn't rate to kill himself. He didn't kill himself because of what he saw in Iraq, because he didn't see shit. Right. And so we begin this dissection of the event. Like, or, hey, who was that guy? What did he do? Well, he was there in 2009. We weren't even fighting there, for God's sakes. I mean, it was more dangerous in Tijuana than it was in Iraq in 2009. So why is he killing himself? And so one of the things that I found is that when you have structural faults in a human being before you bring him into the military, and then you load the stress of combat deployments onto that. And it could be stressed that I recognize it's substantial or not. But let's just say it's legitimate that, that you deploy and you fight. When there's structural flaws there and you load that additional stress and weight, then that finds that that makes those obviously structural flaws worse. And so I think so there are pre-existing conditions in terms of the way you cope with life and things like that, and then you load what you see in combat. Your friends being shot and killed, innocent people being shot and killed, the horrible dance where you're trying to save somebody and you're trying as hard as you can to do it and they're trying as hard as they can to live and it doesn't work and you're left with it in your hands. All of that. And then so I'm thinking of that while you're talking. And so 50% of our marriages end in divorce in this country, approximately. So if you have structural flaws in your marriage and you go and you have these experiences and you load all this additional stress onto your marriage, does it then become more of an understandable, I don't know if it understandable event is the right way to say it, but to me, I see a parallel in there in that there's these structural flaws in people, there's structural flaws in relationships, and going to war and coming back, all it does is it exacerbates those flaws. Does that make any sense to you?
Indeed it does. Indeed it does. I'm reading you loud and clear on that one. Thank you for that.
I don't mind sharing with the group on occasion.
Thank you for that, sir.
You're welcome.
So what really, I appreciate that logic, that reasoning. I very much appreciate that. And it really does provide a unique perspective on, number one, our finding, and number two, the broader discussion of some of the challenges that recently returned veterans might be facing. And to that end, I imagine a lot can be said for wanting to fix those flaws, to wanting to remedy the problem, to better their own situation. And so, as I alluded to earlier, there are a lot of marriage enrichment programs, if we're just speaking about marriage at the present moment, available through the VA, also within one's local communities. A lot of churches, faith-based organizations also provide supportive services aimed at, again, fixing those cracks, those flaws that you alluded to. And so I'm really grateful for that perspective. It really does put things into a broader context.
Well, part of the reason why I say that is those things is I may or may not even know it's a problem yet. But when I come home, I'm changed. I'm probably angrier because I think anger, I don't know where it comes from. But when you come home, you're pissed and you don't deal with, you know, like for me, like if somebody, you know, when somebody tells you to fuck off, but they don't say the words, but they communicate it.
Sure.
I used to be a relatively easygoing middle class Irish Catholic kid. I'm not that kid anymore. And so now you'll hear from me, what did you just say to me? And my kids then go, uh-oh, something bad's about to happen here. And I was never that guy. But I came home with an anger, and I think that's a lot of veterans talk about it. I call it my black blood. I can feel it tingling inside of me when I go down that road. And I can feel it when it explodes kind of in a white-hot fashion when something else, somebody's either rude or I feel violates my person. I can feel this explosion of almost adrenaline, black blood into my body and it's this anger inside of me. But I didn't really know it that well when I first came home. And so she doesn't handle the checkbook right. We didn't save enough money. Right? She screwed that up. And so you come home and you begin to deal with those issues. And I can remember even before we left Iraq, the first time I came home, sitting down with the chaplain, they were trying to do transition classes. And it's like, hey, when you go home, now things might not be perfect, you may have sexual performance issues, and everybody kind of laughs. Come on, Chaplain. Me? And then, and things may not go on the way that, you thought, and you may be in for some surprises. And let me tell you, her perspective is going to be that she had it just as hard as you did. And with that, there was this reaction in the room. What? And the chaplain put his hand up. He goes, and then you heard guys say, that's bullshit. She had it harder than me. We're getting killed over here. Hey, her perspective is that she's taken this burden. She's worried about you. She's dealt with your children and the family. And she's had just as difficult a time as you had. And you would hear guys say, oh, hell no, chaplain. And he would try to simmer that down. So you could see this disconnect, right, even before we came home. And people encountered reality. So I guess when you put all that together, and it's to me, the more I thought about your finding, the more, and then you come home and you say, yeah, well, maybe this isn't for me anymore. And now I'm dealing with my combat stuff, and now I'm dealing with a failed relationship. And, you know, depending on how you deal with it, certainly conditions that put a lot of stress on somebody.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Indeed, perspective is a big deal. Getting your own perspective in order, getting someone else's perspective is sometimes very difficult to bear, to burden, and to really carry. I've heard it described. I've heard it said that in the case of families, especially, it's not just the service member who serves, that it's the whole family who serves. And having that sort of perspective, I imagine, serves as a good starting point if we're talking about marriages and romantic relationships in particular. And the next step from that would really be putting a name to those emotions. Developing, not just having, but really developing healthy relationships. Talking, discussing, what emotions are present, what emotions might not be present. And, some of the success stories that I've been privileged to listen to hear about, to meet with, once they get over those initial hurdles, a lot of times they say that their relationship, that their marriage is at a completely different, better, more beautiful place than it even was before. With that being said, it took a lot of work and effort to get to that point, but I can say that there are people who have made that journey. They have achieved a new dimension, a new level of health to their relationship with their spouses, with their children, with their communities. And that again, it requires a lot of work. I have no qualms about that. It requires accessing positive support systems, really going out and wanting to feel better. And what I can say as a researcher with an absolute full sense of responsibility, getting to that point is an incredibly protective factor for mental health disorders and improving treatment outcomes. And the juice really is worth the squeeze at that point, because in the absence of that, having a strained relationship, the research, the data, the science is very clear that a strained relationship is difficult. It's not healthy, for want of a better term.
So is the takeaway better education for both service members and spouses about the changes that you're going to go through, and that you need to be aware of it? Because if you don't make an effort to close that gap when he or she returns, then that gap is not only going to be exacerbated by time, it's going to be exasperated by the changes that whoever has deployed has undergone. And so you have to make an effort to work at your relationship and to talk and communicate. And that awareness, promoting that awareness, hopefully can mitigate that number, that suicide number?
Absolutely. It would be a step in the right direction. No two ways around that. Education, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Education is part of it. Our knowledge, our understanding of what service members go through, military experiences, what effect that has on the physical, mental, social, spiritual health of the individual, has really grown in huge leaps and bounds in the last year, if not even decades. We are so much better off with what we know now than what we did not know before. And to that end, we can use that knowledge, those facts, really to educate everyone across the board, saying, this is what's going on right here, right now. This is what you're experiencing. Let's put a name to those emotions, and here is a way out. Here is how we can make things better. And so moving beyond education, we're going into the dimension of intervention. Developing specific supportive options and strategies, and I'd like to stress the term evidence-based, that we're not just providing support for support's sake, but we're providing support that will yield a concrete, specific, positive benefit that we know, we can say again, that we know that somebody who engages in this intervention will be that much better off than before they took part in the supportive services. So education, developing interventions, supportive services, and keeping things going with research, having the science develop, having it grow. So while we are able to answer one question, then we also draw attention to other areas, other avenues that are deserving and requiring research and investigation so that we can really begin to answer so many more questions and really improve outcomes across the board.
All right. I want to ask one of the other unique aspects of your study is
yes, sir.
One of the factors that you examined was spirituality.
Indeed.
Okay, talk about that. Because, you know, talk about something that's taboo in modern culture to talk about. Spirituality. Talk about porn all day. Talk about spirituality. Sorry, click, click, click. Everybody turns it off. So talk about spirituality relative to your study.
Okay, thank you for that question.
Sure.
So, spirituality, we are all spiritual beings. Spirituality is part of the human experience. And what I specifically mean by that is this desire for meaning and purpose in life. That is the essence of spirituality. To find what really gets us up in the morning, our reason for getting out of bed. What adds fuel to our fire? What keeps us going? That sense, again, of meaning and purpose. It's part of the human experience. It's part of our understanding of health and illness. The research has been very concrete that in developing this idea of spiritual well-being, there are various ways of measuring it, but ultimately what it boils down to is people who have higher spiritual well-being, who've achieved, again, that sense of meaning and purpose, are really that much better off in health outcomes practically across the board than people who are lacking that sense of spiritual well-being. So that's, in terms of a brief introduction, that's a little bit about what we mean and understand by spirituality. Now, of course, I absolutely agree and mindful that many people will look for spirituality in organized religion, in organized faith services, in the temple, the church, the mosque, the synagogue, and that is absolutely valid in and of itself as well. And so in our study, what we specifically inquired about was this idea of religious coping, religious or spiritual coping by that measure. We asked this group of recently returned veterans about some of their religious coping strategies. And what we found was that it was not a homogeneous experience of how people applied religious coping. And I'll give an example here. Negative religious coping is suggestive of a less secure relationship with God. Simplifying things, somebody who might say that God is punishing them for stuff that they did, stuff that they saw, stuff that they didn't do.
Yeah.
That would fall under the umbrella of negative religious coping. Now, positive religious coping, on the other hand,
I hate negative religious coping. By the way, I met a woman whose son was killed in Afghanistan, and in a vehicle rollover incident. And so we were talking, and she said, you know, the reason it's my fault that he died. And I looked at her and I said, what? And she said, I prayed for him every night, and the night he died, I didn't pray for him, and I know God punished me. And I said, no, it's not the way, that's not the way the cosmic force works.
Oh, you know, Lord.
Exactly. I mean, if you can imagine. And so I spoke to her, but there was nothing I could say that could change what she felt in her heart, that she was at least partially to blame for his death. And I just told her, ma'am, look, there's people who pray every day not to get killed. And the God who governs the flight of metal through the air listens to nobody. And he or she is a fickle entity, because it misses me and hits you. It misses all of us. Or one small piece hits you and it hits you right between the eyes and kills you. And I said, so it wasn't that, I promise you. But she was convinced. And I went home that night. Makes you want to cry.
It breaks your heart.
Because
it
she
really
lived
does.
With this burden, thinking that the fact that she didn't pray, that he was punished for it, and that that was not a random. There was cause and effect relationship there. So I'm not a fan. But again, everybody's different, and we all believe differently, and the way we see the world is different, and it's a powerful stuff that you're talking about.
Indeed, and it carries weight. As you have very, very eloquently described it, negative religious coping, it's a horrible thing. It's a pathology. It really eats you from inside. And just to conclude, what our study found really is that negative religious coping is its own risk factor.
Oh.
That negative religious coping, somebody who is engaged in those kinds of practices and those kinds of thoughts, stands to tangibly increase their risk of suicide. It was really significantly associated with an increased category of suicide risk. People who engaged in negative religious coping. And why our study was unique is that it was significantly associated above and beyond depressive symptomatology. So in essence, it really is its own thing, and our study was effectively the first of its kind to make that point. And so the next step, really, in logical progression, is to identify ways that we can mitigate that. You know, what is it about that thinking of negative religious coping that we have to break that vicious cycle? We have to get the person to start thinking differently.
I was gonna say, how do you do that?
Well, lowest hanging fruit, I would say, is the chaplaincy services that are available in every unit and also at every VA medical center. Chaplains, they are a very unique service provider, really unsung heroes. They have perspectives that other people really don't. And so they can speak to the person. I've seen this firsthand. It's incredible how a chaplain with experience, who has seen and heard so many different things, really knows the right words to say and how to say them that can really get to a person's heart, really speak to them in a way that makes that person then want to listen to the chaplain. And as far as negative religious coping goes, at a theoretical level, conceptual theoretical level, we know that a lot of it is grounded in incorrect or ill-informed understandings of faith. People say that God is punishing me because I did X, Y, Z, or A, B, C. Well, I wouldn't want to be praying to that kind of God either. Let's go back to your faith. Let's talk about the God that you grew up with. Let's talk about this benevolent deity that you were taught that loves you, that cares for you, that would never do any harm to you. Let's reframe that way of thinking about God, and let's uncover a deeper mystery that's inherent in spirituality that can ultimately help this person rediscover that sense of meaning and purpose that was otherwise lacking in their lives. So the take-home message there is one of growth and development. It's not an easy thing, but there are options available, and there are people who are skilled and capable of bringing that sense of relief. And so with that said, I do salute the chaplaincy services at the DOD, at the VA. They really are unsung heroes, and they do great work, great work.
I just got a text message that says they're chaplains, and then there's chaplains, the ones you're talking about. The chaplain, when I went to Afghanistan, one of the most hated officers in the battalion, if you can imagine that. He was one of the biggest jackasses in the battalion. And that's awful because you need him. You need him for a whole variety of reasons. So I don't want to disparage the chaplains at the VA, certainly. Somebody sent me that, and my experience is mixed with chaplains. And when you, like anything else in life, I mean, in any population, there's going to be good and bad and whatnot. My guest this morning, Merrick Kopech. Merrick, can we continue this discussion, in maybe a week or so? Because, I'm not done with you.
Well, I would invite the opportunity. Yes, sir. It would be my wonderful pleasure to continue this discussion. Thank you for the opportunity to be on the air today.
No. First of all, the things that you're talking about, I think, get to real issues, and things that, you know, we kind of pay a little bit of lip service to, but you're kind of drilling into them, I think, helps people. And again, it's not only, you're not only going to deal with this stuff when you come back from your deployment. You're going to deal with it for the rest of your life. Okay, there's a reason that the divorce rate among combat veterans is significant. Okay, there's a reason for that, and that is the additional stress that it adds to relationships, and you may not even understand the changes that have happened to you, let alone the way it's manifesting itself in your marriage, the way you treat her mistakes. And whatnot. So I want to talk. I'd like to develop that a little bit more, if you don't mind. But email question. Hey Mac, where can we find the study that they did? So Merrick, where do we find the study?
Appreciate that. The study is available online. It was published by the Archives of Suicide Research. I imagine there might be an opportunity to add a link on your website. Otherwise, anyone can Google Archives of Suicide Research, and that'll take them to the website. And the title of the study is Religious Coping and Suicide Risk in a Sample of Recently Returned Veterans.
I just found it. Very easy. I will include that link with this segment, and I'll shoot you a link to that, and also I'll shoot you an email, and we'll see if we can sync up sometime next week, maybe a week from today, and continue this discussion, because I have not spoken, and I do this show every day, with somebody who addresses the issues that I saw addressed in your study, which is why I contacted you. And that is things that I hadn't heard before. Everybody knows that women's numbers are going up, so we need to talk about that. But the surprise, you know, finding in the study is you're at higher risk if you're married than you are if you're single. That's very, very, that is the thing that caught my eye. And also the religious aspect of this. And again, I like the way you phrase that. It doesn't simply need to be the organized religious piece. It's the spirituality piece as well. So a lot of people will say, I don't go to church, but I consider myself a spiritual person. And I think they're talking about that. So,
indeed.
So, and your study is one of the few that addresses that. So, thank you very much for doing this today.
It was my wonderful pleasure. Thank you for having me online. And again, I offer my deepest respect and thanks to the service of all your listeners. And I'm humbled to be a part of this bigger conversation. The VA really, it's a wonderful place to work. We are mindful of the sacred responsibility that we have to serving and supporting our nation's veterans. And I just like to drive the point home that we do not take that responsibility lightly, that we are absolutely working diligently to preventing suicide in veterans. It's a tough battle, but by God, we're making headway. We're going to get there.
You know what? God bless you for all the work you do, Merrick. It does save people's lives, and we know that. The VA oftentimes gets a bad rap in the big media, but those of us who are around it a lot and talk to different people know that there's a lot of people working really hard at the VA to make it better, to make the lives of veterans better, and certainly appreciate not only your comments, but also a little bit of a novel experience today. You're educating us on Polish culture. That was awesome.
I'm grateful for that opportunity as well. I'm really a bookworm and history. I've always had an active interest in different historical topics. So it was nice to use some of those skills at the start of the segment.
All right. Well, you just became the Allmarine Radio Polish culture expert. So I hope you don't mind down the road if you get a call, you'll know what it's about. But thank you very much for today.
All the best wishes to everyone. Thank you so much.
There it is. That is Merrick Kolpak. He's got a Z in his last name. Yeah, that's how you know it's Polish. But you can if you do a search on Archives of Suicide Research and you just put his first name, Merrick, M-A-R-E-K, in there, the article pops right up. But I will include it in the link to this segment here when I post it in about an hour. So we're going to take a quick break. The Gunner's going to join us. He's on the road with his lovely wife, Tina. So more of Allmarine Radio coming up next. We'll take a quick break. We'll get Mike on the phone. And, again, just want to thank very interesting findings relative to suicide. And again, it's just not after you come home. It is years and years after that. If you don't get to the point where you can open up communicating, then I think things don't go well. More of Allmarine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.